This is Meg Gardner, and you're listening to Writer Types.
Hey, I'm Lou Burney.
This is Sarah Paretsky.
This is Matthew Quirk.
This is Laura McHugh.
This is Attica Locke.
Well, that's an interesting question.
That's a great question.
That's interesting.
I'm glad you picked up on that.
This is Lee Child, and you're listening to Writer Types.
Welcome to Writer Types. I am your host, Eric Beatner, and joining me today as my guest co-host is Cheryl Head. Thanks for being with me, Cheryl.
My pleasure, Eric. Good to talk to you.
Now, according to your own description, you write about, quote, the funny, interesting, unbearable, loving, dangerous, quirky, despicable people who reside on the planet, which I think that's so great. Now, do you think, does everyone have a story to tell, or are you always on the lookout for just the right ones to tell a story about?
Oh, that's a good question. I think almost everybody has a story to tell. It may be that the story is more a haiku than a novel, however. But, and especially now with coronavirus, where I get to look at people in a different kind of settings and under a certain amount of stress, and I'm observing people doing things a little differently. So I think there are lots of stories to tell.
Yeah, definitely. Well, your Charlene Charlie Mack series is going strong, and you have book 5 is out this month. Has it been surprising to you that she has survived this long?
Yes, especially when my publisher says, "So, what's the next one about?" And I have not a clue. So, but it's fun. I think as I look at her and her cast of characters that surround her, it really helps that she has this crew that works with her. So there's always something going on with them that I can use to weave together both a mystery and a case and some interesting kind of personal problem or some kind of personal growth in the character. So it's fun doing that.
Yeah, I mean, you put a big emphasis, like you say, on sort of the expanded cast of characters. And it really, that's if you want to have a long-running series, I think that's one thing that's really important, is you have to populate it beyond just your main character, right?
I think so. I mean, and when you look at the really successful crime series, they always have the protagonist who is the charming character that you come back to the novel to read about. But it's also that secondary group of people who bring the charm and the funny questions and the idiosyncrasies and help the main character to be seen in a different way. So I use my secondary characters as a way to help Charlie grapple with some of the emotional things. She's kind of an unemotional person. And so I surround her with people that have much more passion and stronger emotions about things. And I think they make a good balance to her.
Yeah, definitely. Well, now this series is set in Detroit, where you are from, but you live in D.C. now. So
right.
Why go back to Detroit for the books?
Because I love Detroit and not D.C. That's the long and short of it.
No, are you trying to unseat Elmore Leonard as the literary hero of Detroit?
That would be hard to do. I read his books a lot and say to myself, why can't I write lean like that, you know? But I'm writing a standalone outside of the Charlie series, and I set it in D.C., and I just got stuck until I realized that I don't have the affection for D.C. that I have for Detroit. And so in the standalone that I'm writing, D.C. is an antagonist and not a protagonist.
Oh, That's interesting. How you can make it work to your advantage.
It finally, I was able to reframe it once I had that epiphany.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, now you do one of the most difficult things that never gets talked about in publishing, which is having themed titles.
Oh my God,
you've got
so hard.
Bury Me When I'm Dead, Wake Me When It's Over, Catch Me When I'm Falling, Judge Me When I'm Wrong, and now Find Me When I'm Lost.
Right.
So two things on this. One, do you regret that choice now 5 books in? And is it harder to come up with a title than it is to come up with a plot?
Such a great question and so prescient. Yes. I just titled and wrote the synopsis for book 6, and it took 3 days to figure out the dang title. Although I have a formula now, and I have a list of titles that fit the formula, and I walk around and I talk to my publisher, and you know, it does make sense in terms of marketing, and it shows up well in the book covers. But it's getting harder now. But I've got the next one coming out. Warn Me When I'm, and I can't even remember the next 2 words. So. But it's warned me.
Okay.
That's the tease.
Well, now you're very good on the microphone, and you make an excellent co-host. But this is not the first time you've been behind a microphone, is it? You're a ringer.
Well, thanks for saying that. Yeah, I had a job as a young person working in public radio in Detroit, and then I worked in public television for a while, and then went back to public radio. And so, yeah, pretty comfortable behind a mic in Detroit. I did a hourly daily show called Community Connections, and I interviewed all kinds of great people, including some crime writers.
Wow. So what am I doing here? You should be hosting this show.
No, that was a long time ago, Eric.
Well, now, we missed each other in Chicago this year at the Murder and Mayhem conference, which is where we met, and I enjoy having a chance to run into you year after year. All that has been shut down. None of us are getting out. We're all trapped at home. How are you dealing with being locked away in quarantine?
Yeah, well, I tell you, it was fun at that Murder and Mayhem conference. That's a really great conference. I really recommend it to people who want to go to a mystery and or crime writing conference. But this coronavirus time is made for me. I get to be home. I don't have to interact with people. If I go to the grocery store, it's not crowded. So it's, you know, for an introvert writer of crime and mystery, it's a pretty darn good time. I do find that I see interactions with people differently. You know, I walk the dog, and I noticed that extroverts are having a really difficult time right now. So they want to run up to you and have conversations, you know, and stuff like that. I see how families are interacting differently. I'm paying attention to nature a bit more, and I'm using all of that to inform my writing.
Well, that's good. So you're still able to be productive. I know some people are having a tough time.
Well, the first few weeks I couldn't write or read. You know, I basically took my temperature and thought I was going to die, you know, but after that, because I'm in one of the cohort groups. So once I realized I was probably safe, I was able to write. But it's stressful. But I found that I can use the stress. Again, I'm good at reframing things.
Yeah.
So I'm using my anger around like Black Lives Matter to write some things that I had put away in a drawer. I pulled them back out, and I'm using Corona's kind of fear and stress to write some new things. So I'm making it work for me.
Oh, that's good. Mm-hmm. There you go. There's your key to getting an idea out of you, is put a little pressure on.
Put some pressure on me. You know, that's the TV part of me.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, we get diamonds from coal, right?
That's right.
Well, I think it's time we welcome our first guest, shall we?
That's a good idea.
All right. Steve Hawkinsmith is one of my absolute favorite writers. His Homes on the Range series of Western mysteries are some of the most fun that you'll have reading a book. He's also written a ton of different stuff that all has his trademark humor, which is snarky and sarcastic, just the way I like it. Cheryl, do you try to balance a little bit of humor in your Charlie Mack books?
I think it's so important to have humor in crime writing, and I have lots of humor in my my Don Rutkowski character is really my vehicle for humor. He's so irreverent and kind of a Neanderthal, but he's a great straight man, so it really helps to put that humor in the book, I think, when you're writing about killing people.
Definitely. Well, I don't know. Maybe even before we get started, Steve, you're definitely you're a funny guy. So maybe Cheryl and I should just turn this over to you and go ahead, be funny.
It's so perfect that you ended that with the be funny, because when you begin it with the you're a funny guy, of course that's the implication, which is why anytime anyone ever says that, I cringe so hard. I remember this one time, my first agent, I was visiting with her in New York, and it was the first time I'd been up to her office, and she was, you know, quite a powerful figure, at least to a little nobody like me, and I was very intimidated to be there. And while we're having our conversation, another one of her clients pops by, and she says, like, you know, Steve, oh, you've got to meet this guy. Steve is the funniest person I've ever met. And then she just sort of turns to me. Yeah, it was the worst. Oh, I felt like such a rube. So all that just to say, Thanks, Eric. Thanks.
That's my job as host.
To make us feel like rubes. Well, yes.
Yeah.
Well done.
There you go. All right. Well, Steve, you are a hard one to pin down in the writing world. You've written a series of mysteries set in the Old West. You've got middle grade books for kids. You have zombie novels, a cozy series. What kind of writer do you consider yourself?
Wow, that's a great question. And it's funny that I find myself at a little bit of a loss because, of course, it's something I think about all the time. I'm, you know, we writers, we think about ourselves all the time, and particularly, you know, our writing and where our writing fits into anything. And yet just the whole question of like, well, what kind of writer are you, Steve? I have never thought of it quite like that. It's always sort of like, where are the opportunities or what are you good at? I guess, you know, one thing I've, and again, this is just to go to show what a mistake it is ever to start a conversation with, you're a funny guy, because when you get me started talking on this stuff, I get so very earnest and I just feel like I become very boring very quickly. So I'm sorry about that. But what is one trying to do with this writing thing? And we all feel the impulse, we want to create something, but you know, what's the point? Is it we just want to be published, or we want to put a smile on people's faces? We want to bring a rainbow into the world. What is it we're doing? And I guess for myself, it's sort of come back to being an entertainer, which doesn't mean like putting on a funny nose and going waka waka and a little song, a little dance, a little seltzer in the pants. Mm-hmm. But it does mean keeping in mind the relief a good story can bring in a sad, sad world. Boy, I'm as unfunny as possible, aren't I?
No, but it's sincere, and I think that's as much as any author can ask for, is, like you say, to entertain, because we're putting down words in order to hand to somebody else to say, here, escape your world for a little while and come into ours.
Yeah, exactly. Like I just got an email the other day, which is one of those emails that keeps you going for the rest of the week, and it was like, you know, I just stumbled onto your books through whatever, and I've been having a real rough time, and I've really enjoyed the books. It really helped me this week. That makes me feel like Mother Teresa in my own lame way.
I have a question for you. You have a new short story in the latest Ellery Queen. Congrats.
No, thank you very much.
Your Holmes on the Range series started as a short story. So do you begin each of your short stories with the idea to become a novel?
No, I'm always very clear when I start writing something exactly what I'm trying to do at that time. Like I hear writers on, let's say, writer types talking about their writerly process. And I hear people who talk about, you know, they start as something that's going to be a short story and then it turns into a novel. Or they start something that they think is going to be a novel, but then they realize it's a short story. And this is not to sound superior, but that doesn't happen to me. I never had that surprise. Yeah, to me, it's always like, you know, what am I going to do with myself right now? Oh, I'm going to write a novel, and it's going to be X kind of novel. And then I do that novel. Or I'm going to write a short story. And this, you know, gets, I guess, into the question of sort of like, again, the writerly process. I'm a very, very meticulous outliner. Mm-hmm. And so that helps, you know, with the clarity of purpose here. Like, I'm going to write a short story. The thing that always changes is that everything does always end up being longer than mm-hmm. I think it should be or would be. But the difference in length is I think it's going to be 4,000 words and it ends up being 8,000 words, as opposed to I think it's going to be 3,000 words and it ends up being 110.
Yes, right. That is kind of a leap. Do you find the short story structure more challenging than doing a novel?
Yes and no. I mean, I hear again people on writer types talking about how they really wrestle with the challenges of writing a short story, and I get that. But to me, I'm trying to find a nice way to say, like, I guess I'm lucky. I can do both.
You're a genius.
Well, yeah, exactly. So once we've accepted that premise, then it sort of explains everything else. This will sound dumb, and we can add this to all the dumb things I've probably already said. Novels, to me, are actually much harder because they're longer. So, like, you can boil it down to that. Like, why are short stories easier? They're short. Why are novels harder? they're big.
You've given some great advice here. Absolutely. That I think a lot of authors need to know is that short stories are easier because they're shorter. And just so we can put it out there in case any colleges are listening, are you available for professorship?
Anytime. I mean, I know this is a glorious golden age for higher education in the United States. So, you know, I know all universities are staffing up right now, building that faculty out for the fall. So, yeah, I am available. Please, you know, get that classroom, that virtual classroom prepped. I can Zoom in anytime.
It would be a very short class.
Yeah. Short story short, novels long, class dismissed. Everybody gets an A.
That's right.
You took a long break between Holmes on the Range novels, but you were back with yet another one pretty recently. What was it like getting back in the saddle with Old Red and Big Red?
It was both easy and not easy. I feel like my answers are always going to be so ridiculously simple and yet so stupidly wordy. Yes, it was both easy and hard. And it was easy in that I loved those characters and still felt very connected to those characters and really understood how to use those characters. And it was hard in that writing books is hard. So we've come back to another one of my brilliant insights into writing. Writing books is really hard. And writing those books is hard in their own way, in that there's a very particular sort of voice. And because they're historical novels, there's a lot of research. Mm-hmm. And even though I am a gabby old man, I wasn't born in the 19th century. So I find that I have to stop a lot and just sort of figure out when they walk into a room, what's in there? Or, you know, if somebody has to go to the bathroom, what's that process like in 1894? It's a lot more complicated than it is today, or at least it seems, you know, from our perspective. So I just get hung up a lot. And also, you know, to get to the writerly process again, I am both a meticulous / anal outliner and a very slow, meticulous writer, in that I kind of get everything in on the first pass. I don't do a ton of revision because I write so painstakingly slowly. And so I just get hung up a lot and have to really fight with sentences sometimes to make sure they feel right before I move on.
I want to ask you about a blog you wrote recently about your dad, who you lost last year. Sorry for that, and it's his Father's Day. But also, he was a big fan of Westerns, and that's sort of how you came to your love of Westerns, and I'm a big fan of Westerns, too. So how does that kind of inform your outlook as a mystery writer?
Yeah, you know, he was also a very big Sherlock Holmes fan. And so if you look at what kind of launched me into the novel writing world, which was Holmes on the Range, you know, a novel that combined Westerns and Sherlock Holmes, mm-hmm. It goes right back to my dad. Not every aspect of who I am as a writer, for sure, mm-hmm. Which is just to say my dad wouldn't like everything I write. he wasn't a zombie guy, for sure.
Exactly.
It's been about 20 years now since you've first published your first shorts. So if in that 20 years that you've been publishing fiction, is the body of work that you've created anything like what you expected back then?
Wow, what a question. Wow. Oh my. You see, this is a real soul-searching moment. You've just asked me to assess my body of work. That's rough, man. Oh, you need to prepare me for that one. Oh gosh. And then to face the question of like, dude, did it live up to what you hoped? And like, Well,
here, I'll reframe it for you. Are you as much or more of a failure as you thought you would be? That seems like that's more in your wheelhouse, Steve.
Yeah, no, it is. So yeah, I'd say like but you know, it's funny because it again becomes a both a very simple answer and one that feels hard to say in one sentence. Boy, this is okay.
Try and focus, Steve. We got other guests.
Well, because I am naturally at heart a deeply pessimistic person, a part of me always expected failure. But you can't go into writing expecting to be a failure, although one probably should. You know, to do the work and to put yourself out there in that way, of course, you have to be optimistic. You have to be doing it because you think it's going to reach people. And you have to have dreams, right? And so in the beginning, I think I had very high hopes of making a mark in a way that I'm not so sure I did. But I can look back at the stuff I've done and feel that I've almost always stayed true to my own unique vision of who is Steve Hawkinsmith as a writer. I've almost everything I've done, only I could have done it, which isn't to say it's so superb and only a Steve Hawkinsmith could achieve these levels of genius, but just that they're so weird and goofy in that Steve Hawkinsmith way. Only Hawkinsmith would write that. In that way, I guess I'm pretty happy.
Oh, good.
That's excellent. So I am so envious that you can write across genres. I cannot do that. So is there anything you are afraid to tackle when you're writing?
I don't write about sex very often. Mm-hmm. In fact, almost never.
Probably wise.
Yeah.
It's a real stumbling block for a lot of people.
It really is. Yeah. You know, it's hard to do well. You know, there's all sorts of reasons to make fun of me. I don't have to really make it easy for people. Well, you know, I get very nervous around certain subjects. You know, like this is something Eric knows all about because of Eric's anthologies he's done about gun violence. Mm-hmm. And some of the conversations he's had about that. I do really find myself wrestling with the Western stuff that I have wanted to do. I've kind of wanted to go off into that genre a bit more.
Yeah.
But I'm really finding myself feeling very ambivalent about some of its messages, or at least yeah. the messages that are baked into a certain mainstream aspects of the genre. I'm just getting more and more boring, aren't I?
No, I totally understand.
But yeah, like I'm sort of wrestling with if I even want to write a certain kind of Western or action-y kind of book anymore. Is that okay for entertainment? Is it okay mm-hmm. to have fun with that? And I, the answer to me used to be, sure, yeah, it's just fun. And now I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's such guilty pleasure in enjoying Westerns because it's filled with sexism and racism and they're killing Indians left and right. And I love the genre. So as a Black woman, I keep that on the down low.
Yeah, absolutely. That gets into a whole other thing that makes me nervous about it is the whole cultural aspect of it. You know, I've thought about writing a Holmes on the Range novel that would, let's say, take place, near an Indian reservation. But and because there are so many very interesting historical issues that could easily become crime fiction plots.
Yes.
And yet the level of research that you'd have to do, I think, to do justice to the culture and make sure that you're being respectful.
Yes.
Is really daunting. And but also at the same time, I don't want it to be like, well, I'm a white guy, I should write white guys, you know?
Yes.
You know, it's just part of our job to get into other people's heads. And which is where, of course, a lot of the Western genre has failed spectacularly. Yeah. But the thing about doing that is that it's hard. So I have now put out these great writing lessons that short yeah. stories are short, novels are long, and thinking like other people is hard. So
yes. You're a great professor, Steve. Yeah, we love your class.
Where's my apple for the teacher?
Well, I think you nailed the perfect condensed writing degree. We all basically have MFAs now after speaking with you, Steve.
Wow, after a 10-minute conversation with me, yeah, you're ready for an MFA. Mission accomplished.
So Steve Hawkinsmith right there, taking us to school there, Cheryl, giving us some solid advice.
He's funny and profound.
Yes.
Things are hard and short is better.
It's amazing that we still need to be reminded of such basic concepts.
It's Confucius, baby.
Well, our next guest is Sarah Sliger, debut author of Take Me Apart, which is a suspense novel about a former journalist who digs into a famed photographer who died years ago, and she ends up finding out a lot about herself as her curiosity spirals into obsession. The book has made a lot of most anticipated lists and is already on some best of lists of 2020. So Cheryl, building suspense is, to me, it's kind of the hardest part of writing, isn't it?
Yes,
I mean, you can write
really
thrills that last a page or action that goes quick, but sustained suspense is kind of a high wire act.
That's right. That's when you're really doing the craft of the work, and the people who can do that, I so admire. I think that Sarah does a really fine job of it. And for a debut novel, it's such an ambitious undertaking, I'll say, without giving it away.
Sarah Slager, thanks for joining us. And you're here with Take Me Apart, your debut novel. So congratulations on that. And I mean, is it as thrilling as you expected to have a debut in the spring of 2020? Is it all just champagne and limousines?
Yes, exactly. That has been my spring 2020. Absolutely. It's been weird releasing a book at this time. It is my first book, so, you know, I don't have a lot of other stuff to compare it to. So, you know, I guess that's a positive. But there were a lot of, you know, like plans for book tours and book festivals and things like that that did have to get canceled. You know, I haven't even seen my book in a bookstore yet, actually. Oh. I am not getting to meet readers face to face.
Well, just think about how different the next one's going to be. It's going to be like having a debut all over again.
Yes, I hope so. Actually, you know, there's been a lot of like really nice things about having the sort of Zoom and virtual event kind of thing get going, is that I've been able to talk to a lot of other authors and podcast hosts and people who I might not have otherwise been able to speak so easily with. So there are pluses and minuses. That's me trying to find the silver lining.
You're doing a good job. You know, and I wanted to congratulate you on the quality of the book, but also the execution of your marketing, Sarah. You and your publicist and your marketing team did a fabulous job in the launch of the book. Just wonderful. How much pressure then do you feel from the success of the debut for whatever your next piece of work is?
I have to give so much credit to my publisher, MCD, which is a division of Far Stars and Giroux. And I just love the team there. They're so creative. Really, I think even before, you know, the pandemic hit and shelter in place hit, have been really keyed into sort of virtual and digital marketing. And they put a lot of time and care into this book. I think I feel positive pressure in that, you know, like some people have been like, oh, I'm so excited to like read your next book. That's a good motivator. But yeah, I haven't had like the negative, that negative feeling of like too much
pressure.
Oh my God. Yeah, but I feel like maybe, you know, maybe closer to the release date or something of the second book, I might start to feel that more.
Well, you're a real glass half full kind of person, Sarah. This is a rare thing to find in the writing world.
I try. I mean, yes, you know, I think today is a glass half full kind of day. Maybe not every day.
Okay. Well, it is just your debut. Give us a couple years and we'll beat it out of you.
Yeah, exactly. I still have time to become jaded.
Right. Well, so in the book, Kate has to reconstruct the life of famed photographer Miranda Brand, and it requires her to examine really every little detail in Miranda's life. She's a bit of a voyeur in you know, digging into this. So I think we all as writers have to be a little bit of that voyeur, right? Is that something that you've always, a quality you've always had?
Yeah, I am just like so fascinated by other people's stories and watching and observing and eavesdropping. Moving to Los Angeles, where I live, it's very hard to take public transit, and I do really miss like eavesdropping on subways and buses, which I used to do a lot. But yeah, you know, Kate is she's going through this sort of huge collection of the photographer's artifacts. And I'm also an academic and spent a lot of time in archives. And I wanted to kind of channel that. I think you're really right. It is a very voyeuristic impulse to find out everything you can about this other person's private life. And there you become very invested in this person who, you know, in most instances, if you're researching old documents, especially a lot of the documents I worked at are from like the 1920s. So a lot of people who produce those are no longer living. And so it's a very one-way kind of relationship. And that was something that I was really interested in conjuring.
Following up on Eric's question, there was a lot of weaving of revelations about each woman in the book and digging into their inner lives. How difficult as a craft process was it to kind of maintain the suspense while you were doing that?
Really hard. I think, you know, I mean, I had a lot of ambition when I went into the project. I don't know if I realized how difficult it would be to kind of have these two women's stories unfold. And for anyone who hasn't read the book, the kind of premise is that parts of it are told in the present day through Kate, the archivist's perspective, that alternates with documents from Miranda, the photographer's life. So you're sort of like seeing these documents as Kate sees them and uncovers them. There was just so much revision and like reordering that had to go in it because I was trying to figure out how to maintain the suspense of Miranda's narrative, the suspense of Kate's narrative, and then like the suspense arc of like their stories together. Mm-hmm. And you're sort of balancing, you know, there are moments when like Kate knows something that Miranda doesn't, Miranda knows something Kate doesn't. They're in different time periods. The reader finds things out at different paces. So it was very challenging to do, but I think we got there in the end.
Yes.
When you're trying to do that much interweaving, I mean, it can be easy to sort of lose the thread along the way too, right?
Yeah, definitely. In some ways, like even so, I didn't, you know, plot it out very carefully before I started writing. And as a result, I had to do a lot of really intense revisions, like really rewriting it start to finish, you know, 6 times at least. Ooh. And it was a challenging rewrite process. But then at the same time, I think that even if I had planned it out better, I would have had to do some of that rewriting and reordering, because it's like only after kind of assembling it all are you able to sort of see like, this theme got dropped here and like sort of fell out of some of the documents or some of the narrative, and then kind of like tie it back in.
You touched on something right there that I heard you talk in another interview about this that I just want to get this out there, because you said something that I agree with so passionately about writing first drafts. And there's sort of a pervasive idea out there among a lot of writers, and I think people giving young writers advice that, oh, the first draft doesn't have to be good. And it's supposed to be a bunch of junk, and then you'll sort it out later. I so vehemently disagree with this. Maybe because I'm not a rewriter, I don't like the revision process, but it sounds like you sort of got into a little bit of a pickle with that. You know, do you think if you had taken that first draft maybe a little more, not seriously, it makes it sound like you did, obviously you took it seriously, but do you think that there was a little bit of that process that could have made the revision portion easier if the first draft wasn't just sort of trying to blurt it out on the page?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And I think that I did learn a lot of, like, you know, I mean, it was very difficult the way I chose to do it. And I mean, I didn't really consciously choose. I was following this advice, as you say, like, oh, you know, just like put out this like bad first draft and you can fix it in revision. It's actually very hard with, you know, a crime novel or anything really plot driven that rests a lot on, you know, information being revealed at different points and planting clues, because then, you know, it's really like any bit that you change in revision is going to impact the rest of the book so much. And so I'm like, I don't know what the book would have turned out to be if I'd written in a different way, because I did what I did. But I will say that with the book that I am now working on, my second book, I felt very conscious of like, okay, I can't go through what I went through with Take Me Apart again, because I just feel like it was just so, I mean, I actually like revision in a lot of ways, but I just felt like it was so unproductive. I think the problem with that advice, which, you know, does work for some people, but I do think the problem is that sometimes it encourages young writers to just put out any old thing. And
right,
it's hard when you have something that's like a complete manuscript in terms of like numbers of words or something. It's hard to look at that and then be like, oh, this is all bad. This is not what I wanted to do. And I think, like, you know, a lot of thought has to go into some of the preliminary stuff and kind of like you know, setting yourself up for success, as like a business self-help book might say.
Definitely.
I also teach creative writing, and it's interesting. Like, I do think there are some students who do need that, because they can get so bogged down with the taking care over every sentence that it's hard for them to move forward.
Yeah.
But I also think there are other students who are, you know, like, oh, like I'll write like 4,000 words in a day. And I'm like, well, it's very unlikely that if you write 4,000 words in a day, like any of them will be very good. Like, it's just unlikely, I think.
So it sounds like you're in California in the higher ed system, dashing people's hopes, Sarah.
That's me. Yes, exactly. I'm sure if you talk to any of my students, I would just be, they're like, oh yeah, she's such a, what's the word?
Dream killer.
Dream killer. Yes. That's what they say. Yes. That's what all my evaluations say.
Seriously, I looked at your academic background, and it's really fascinating. I, in particular, love the descriptor that's in your under your pull down. This is academic work that your research projects quote study how justice and violence are differentiated across the axes of race, class, and gender. That was so fascinating to me. Wondered how that research informs your crime writing in general and your current book.
Yeah, it's a good question. Sometimes I'm not even fully aware of all of the ways in which my academic work and my creative work intersect, because they're definitely coming out of a lot of the same concerns with violence and equity and trauma and sort of like this experience, but they're definitely written from sort of different perspectives. Yeah, so I studied sort of the development of the legal procedural, so kind of courtroom dramas, and mm-hmm. looking at how that intersected with the criminal rights movement. And it has led me, I mean, I've read a lot of crime fiction in general, but then also for all of this research, and had to do a lot of really, you know, deep structural kind of analysis of it. And it has helped me understand, I think, the driving forces, the structure of crime fiction in a kind of different way.
Then somehow you did not end up writing sort of a modern day Perry Mason. I mean, it seems like Kate is much more of Sarah the academic than a product of your academic research.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it is that, you know, my academic research kind of comes at it from a perspective of saying, there are some really dangerous consequences that the sort of popularization of legal procedural have had for the way that we understand our criminal justice system. And, you know, in the past few weeks, this kind of conversation has really sort of rocketed into a different level of public attention. There's always been attention given to it, but it's now become, you know, much more focused on. And so I felt like I was just so hyper aware of some of the ways that plays out, that I didn't want to write a crime novel that seemed like it was valorizing a system that I feel to be, you know, very flawed.
Well, Sarah, you know, we're rooting for you on book number two. When that comes out, we hope that people are not trapped in their homes and unable to get out. I hope you can see a book in a bookstore. Yes. That is one of the fundamental things of having your first book out. So I hope the next one, you know, goes a little better.
Yes. Well, actually, a bookstore near me did open recently. So I think I'm going to take a field trip this week.
You should.
Yeah.
And lots of selfies, Sarah, holding your book in the bookstore.
Definitely.
With a mask.
Yes, of course. Right. Yes, absolutely.
Well, Sarah is another one of those debut authors that I can't help be a little bit jealous of.
We're jealous.
Yeah, those people who nail it right out of the gate. Darn them.
Good for her. I hope that sounded sincere. I do. No, I really. She's a wonderful woman, and she's a smart woman, too. Wow.
Oh, yes. So there you have it, Cheryl. That's another episode done. I want to thank you so much for joining me today, and congratulations on your newest novel, Find Me When I'm Lost.
Thank you very much, Eric. Please keep writing, and please keep doing this podcast. You're great at it.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Well, hopefully we'll be back in Chicago next year, or there'll be some time when we can see each other in person. But
that's right.
You know, the one thing I found during all this is even if you can't see people in person, when you're friends with authors, if you have their books, they're still kind of with you in a way, right?
Oh, isn't that sweet? I don't. Yes. Okay. If you say so.
Look how deep I am. Sure.
You are so deep. You and Steve. I feel like a slacker.
Come on. Hey, you brought up Confucius. Come on.
That's right. Okay. I'll take credit for that.